Mark Brown noticed immediately that someone was in the system. Except for the highly publicized Degrees for Sale incident 3 years earlier in 1985, nothing very damaging had happened to the USC computer system in the past few years. Brown was now manager of research and development for USC's computing services, and he had all but forgotten about the two teenagers who had so boldly waltzed onto campus and broken into the system 6 years earlier. But now, someone was dialing into the USC system from off campus. Having found a bug in the system, the intruder was able to modify the VMS operating system subprogram that acted as the computer's gatekeeper. Brown had to admit, the trespasser was extremely clever. Somehow, the electronic interloper had altered the program that supervised user logins so that every time someone logged into the computer, a copy of the password was slightly jumbled and stored in an innocuously named place inside a file. And he had altered the program so it left open a back door that allowed him to return any time to harvest the passwords. But there was a flaw. In trying to cover his tracks at the same time that he was installing his rogue code in the system, the thief occasionally crashed some of the USC computers accidentally. Users around the campus, of course, simply assumed that the system had crashed. It was the sort of annoyance that users expected from time to time. But Brown could tell that these crashes were connected to the break-in. From what he could gather, he had fallen victim to the infamous West German Chaos Computer Club, which had achieved international notoriety that fall after claiming responsibility for a summer of poking around inside NASA's SPAN computer network, an international web of computers used by scientists for space and physics research. The Chaos Computer Club had attacked the NASA VAX computers using the very same software trick. They called their program the Login-Out Patch. Whoever was breaking into USC wasn't just installing the Login-Out Patch, but was using the school's computer as a launch pad to break into other computers on the ARPANET. That was precisely what Chaos had done on the SPAN network, and since most of the activity seemed to occur in the late afternoon and early evening, it made sense that West German troublemakers would be at work late into the night from Hamburg or Hanover or Berlin or wherever they lived. A second odd occurrence left Brown even more concerned. Soon after the break-in started, he noticed that disk space was disappearing from a USC computer with thousands of user accounts dedicated to coursework in physics and chemistry. Huge chunks of storage capacity, 40 megabytes at a time, the equivalent of dozens of textbooks, were being eaten up with no corresponding files to account for the missing space. After a few days of pulling apart the operating system in a hunt for the source of the mysterious problem, Brown finally figured out that the intruder was creating files and disguising them as system index files, which are directories that describe other files, the last place anyone would think to look. When Brown opened the files to examine them, he was amazed. Someone was salting away the source code, closely guarded original programs, for Digital Equipment's proprietary VMS operating system. Brown didn't want to simply lock out a trespasser who had entered privileged accounts and seemed to know the operating system. There was no telling what might happen if USC locked him out. It might make him angry enough to find his way in again and start doing some real damage, deleting files or crashing systems. Software designers write source code in what are called high-level languages. A translator, known as a compiler, then converts the high-level code to binary form. Ones and zeros that can be understood by a digital computer, but are difficult for humans to decipher. Computer companies guard their human-readable source code files as if they were the crown jewels. Only the binary code, which cannot easily be understood or modified, is distributed to customers. In this, computer companies are like a master chef who serves a six-course meal without giving away the recipe. A competitor can easily copy a computer's hardware, but recreating the operating system that runs on that computer is a far more difficult and expensive undertaking. Companies guard their source code not only because they are worried about competition, but also because access to source code makes it easier for a saboteur to open a secret back door into the computer, known as a Trojan horse. A Trojan horse is a seemingly innocent program planted inside a computer that is designed for a special purpose, such as capturing passwords or even destroying data. It is often difficult to tell that a change has been made. Access to source code can make the planning and execution of Trojan horses easier. The thief was stealing digital's lifeblood. Millions of lines of software that run on most of the VAX computers in the world, and electronically stashing it in the USC computers. Furthermore, whoever was doing this wasn't just taking any old VMS code, he was copying the very latest version, called VMS version 5.0, and the only place from which he could have been lifting this software was a group of development computers at Digital's laboratory in New Hampshire. Version 5.0 was so new that digital customers themselves didn't have it yet, and would eventually get only parts of it on microfiche. Perhaps the intruder had managed to break into EasyNet, Digital's internal network, which connected tens of thousands of digital computers around the world. From EasyNet, the interloper must have found a gateway to the USC machine on an academic network. Brown guessed that this thief was keeping his loot on ice at USC because he didn't have enough storage capacity of his own, or he didn't want to be caught with the stolen goods. Every time the pilferer logged out, Brown opened the files to see what was in them. He watched in amazement as Digital's trade secrets scrolled by on the screen. Within just a few weeks, many megabytes of disk space had been consumed in the process of stashing stolen material in the illicit treasure chest. But when Brown called Digital's security department about the theft taking place seemingly under the company's nose, he was surprised again, this time by the lukewarm reception he received. He could understand that the world's second-largest computer manufacturer, with tens of thousands of customers around the world, including a growing number of banks and government agencies, wouldn't be eager to have it widely known that some thief was breaking into its computers and making off with its most prized software. After all, what did that say about the safety of information stored on the customers' computers? But Brown wanted to stop this thief, and assumed Digital would rush to offer its full support. He was hoping that the company would arm him with some high-tech monitoring technology that would enable him to peek electronically over the invader's shoulder while he was in the act of burying his plunder. He had heard that Digital had special programs that allowed a system operator secretly to watch people who were on the system in real time, that is, while they typed. When he called the local Digital office, he explained the situation.
"Look, we've got this guy breaking in here," Brown said, "and it's pretty big time. He's got some of your sources."
Brown asked if he could get one of the company's monitoring programs. He was told to wait for a return call. The call came from Chuck Bushy, the chief security investigator at Digital headquarters in Massachusetts. But instead of offering to send a team out to Los Angeles to investigate the situation, Bushy asked for an account on the USC system so that his experts could look things over themselves. He promised he would send Brown the monitoring programs he was asking for, but the software never came. From that point forward, Brown felt that the matter had drifted out of his hands. Digital didn't seem exactly to be denying that someone had penetrated the very core of the company, but the company wouldn't acknowledge, to Brown anyway, the gravity of the situation. From his conversation with Bushy, Brown got the impression that Digital was somehow trying to brush the matter off. It was like dealing with the Pentagon. Brown surmised that while the security people appeared phlegmatic, software engineers back in Massachusetts were madly scampering to plug their security holes. The Digital security experts seemed much more concerned with the lax security all over EasyNet, it wasn't called EasyNet for nothing, than with the fact that the company's source code was being stolen. Brown could have built his own VMS monitor, a program for watching the intruder's keystrokes while he was on the USC system, but it would have been time-consuming and tricky. VMS was an esoteric, user-unfriendly operating system. It wasn't built for customers who liked to tinker under the hood. It was built for large commercial and scientific customers who were content never to touch it because they expected Digital to handle their problems. So after a handful of unsatisfying encounters with the people in Massachusetts, Brown threw up his hands and decided to let the intruder keep his millions of characters of disk space and have at it. After all, he didn't seem to be hurting anything on the USC computer. And although this was a lot of space being given to some uninvited guest, it wasn't more than an engineering graduate student might use up in one night. All he could do, Brown decided, was to keep careful logs of what he was able to see. The intruder became bolder. He was beginning to use the USC system as a way into other computers more frequently. So Brown shut down access to his privileged accounts on the system. And no sooner had he done that than the Brian Reed hoax happened. Chris Ho, who worked with Mark Brown at USC, got a telephone one afternoon in August from someone who identified himself as Brian Reed from Stanford. "We're having a break-in here, and it looks like he's coming from USC," said the caller. "We need a privileged account on your system so we can track him down."
"Sure," Ho replied. "Just give me a number where I can call you back and we'll set it up."
"I'm not in my office right now."
"Oh, then give me a time when I can reach you and I'll call you back then."
"I'll have to get back to you." With that, the caller hung up. Chris Ho was more than a little skeptical of the call he had just received. He called Stanford at once to check on Brian Reed, a Stanford computer science professor. A secretary in the computer science department told him that Reed had left Stanford to work at Digital in the company's Western Research Lab in Palo Alto. Ho's suspicion confirmed, his curiosity led him to follow through. He called the Digital office in Palo Alto, and after several days of leaving messages and imploring secretaries to get Reed to the telephone, he finally succeeded. Reed needed to utter no more than two words for Ho to detect the difference between Reed and the imposter. Where the timbre of Reed's voice was deep and resonant, the earlier caller had spoken in a much higher pitch, as if each word got trapped in his larynx before escaping from his mouth. No, Reed assured the anxious USC worker he had not called Chris Ho, and yes, he had been aware of the break-ins at Digital for months. After the phone hoax drew new attention to USC's plight, cooperation from Digital improved considerably. In October, Bushy flew out to Los Angeles and met with Brown and Ho. But Bushy seemed interested only in logging the intruder's every move, and Brown knew what that would mean. Late-night vigils for the next 2 months, or until whoever was using USC as an electronic warehouse was caught. He wasn't exactly eager to lose weeks of sleep to help Digital, but he agreed to keep a watchful eye on the situation.